Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Wendell Pierce, whose new book is The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken. We'll also talk with Elise Blackwell, whose new novel is The Lower Quarter. It's such a pleasure to welcome native son Wendell Pierce to The Reading Life to talk about his fine new memoir, The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken. Television watchers know Wendell from his impressive body of work as Bunk in The Wire, Antoine Batiste in Tremé, and New Orleans theatergoers who were lucky enough to see him in Paul Chan's production of Waiting for Godot in 2007. Wendell Pierce, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I love this book so much. My proof copy is starting to fall apart.
Thank you so much.
I'd like to talk about it not particularly as a Katrina book, because it is certainly that, but it is so much more. And really what I admire about it is that it's an important look at becoming an artist and growing up in New Orleans. And you seem to have received a lot of gifts, not only from your family, but from the city as a young man. I wonder if you'd talk about those.
Well, you know, when I did Waiting for Godot, the Lord Knight's War, it was such an awakening and an epiphany for me, a reminder of the transformative nature of art. It was such a cathartic moment when I said, at this place, in this moment of time, all mankind is us. Let us do something while we have the chance. And I saw longshoremen next to lawyers and housewives and people from disparate walks of life across the city just have this cathartic moment with me of understanding where we were and how we can now exercise our right of self-determination. And I realized the power that art is and how important culture is, that intersection between life and how people interact with it. And then the other awakening was that relationship of culture and art and its importance, not just a piece of entertainment, but as a visceral, tangible thing, was always a part of the legacy and history of our city of New Orleans. There's no place else in the world that lives its culture tangibly like New Orleans. Our creativity is vital to who we are, and it's not just the pleasurable part of it. It is the tangible, visceral, rejuvenating aspect of how it leads us in our daily lives, step by step. I mean, we look at our culinary art. We take scraps of food with a little burnt oil and flour and create a roux and create a gumbo. Our culinary art literally gives us sustenance. How we had those captured Africans in Congo Square who found their freedom in their artistic expression in the creation of jazz before they literally found their physical freedom. Mm-hmm. We have social aid and pleasure clubs. We all understand the pleasure part, but
yes,
it was practical. You know, it was practical. It was that benevolence and the benevolent society where we pool our money to make sure if your mama takes sick, Susan, we'll take care of you and the family. If your daddy passes away, we're going to send him off nice. It's practical down to the umbrella and the handkerchief.
But
if anybody's ever been in that hot August sun and needs to wipe their face with that sweat, and that's what our culture is in New Orleans. Our culture is a tangible, visceral thing, that forum where we reflect on who we are.
And you learned that growing up in Pontchartrain Park, going to Ben Franklin High School, going to NOCA. And then, like many young New Orleans artists, you had to leave home to further your craft and your professional education. And that took you to New York, where you met some amazing folks. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the influence of Wynton and Branford Marsalis, for example.
Yeah, well, that journey that you were just speaking of from New Orleans to New York started in New Orleans. I met Wynton when I was 13. He was 15 years old. And I saw genius then. I heard genius then. I went to NOCA where we were put in an environment where it said to be an artist is a thing of great dedication It's of great importance. It's not frivolous. You're not in a drama club. You are becoming a theater artist. You heard some of the best artists in the world becoming who they were ultimately going to be at a very young age. And I was in a pool of talent from Wynton and Branford Marsalis, Donald Harrison and Terrence Blanchard, Harry Connick Jr., Brad Richard, who now teaches creative writing and is published. He's at Milken now. When Tom Whalen was the creative writing teacher then, it was an atmosphere that said to you, it is important to be an artist. But also, we understood that we probably would have to break that Louisiana tradition of never moving 100 miles from home,
mm-hmm.
and that you may have to go out into the world to be a professional artist. And so Dr. Tom Tews even said that, you know, except the fact you're probably going to leave Louisiana for a while to be a professional artist if you choose that route. But the one thing it taught me was culture was going to always connect me to home, no matter how far I traveled.
That's certainly a roll call of great artistic names, you know, that are familiar to us. And I was fascinated to read that when you were in New York at Juilliard at night, you go out with Wynton and Branford to these jazz clubs, and you said that jazz musicians really taught you how to become an actor.
Yes. I used to go to Juilliard during the day, and then at night, go out with Wynton and Branford. We'd go to the jazz clubs and all, and I'll never forget. I literally remember the moment when I learned how to understand Shakespeare, how the whole idea of freedom within form. And I was humming along. I was at the Village Vanguard listening to Arthur Blight, and it was a very avant-garde sort of jazz musician. And he had this very melodic tune, and I was humming the melody of the song along with the band. And then he went into his solo, wild, free form, dissonant, all over the place. But I kept humming the song. And when he finished his solo and came back to the melody, he and I were right in sync. And then I realized, as wild and crazy as I thought his solo was, he never, never forgot the form of the song. And then I realized you can have freedom within form. You can honor the form of the music. You can honor the form of the song and still find your individuality within it, with the way you improvise. And that was Shakespeare.
And you,
iambic pentameter. And then understanding that those words in the script may be very finite, but the way you play it can be infinite.
And you also had the opportunity to cross wits with Stanley Crouch.
Yes. Stanley challenged us as young men to never do anything arbitrarily. Stanley knew that we were serious young men. Stanley knew that there should always be a point and perspective to the work that you do. And it just bolstered the idea of art is not arbitrary. It's not just a piece of entertainment. It's transformative. It is one of the things that you can be very profound, especially when you give vision, focus, and purpose to it, even more than the impact that it has in the immediacy of its creation. Don't tread lightly with it. Be profound with it. And, you know, Stanley was in the long line of influences, and the next was Albert Murray, who literally explained the concept of culture being the intersection between life and a people and how they deal with it. That literal intersection is your culture, and it's a tangible thing. It's not ethereal. It's not just anecdotal. It is not just an idea or a conceit. It is something visceral, strong, tangible, and useful in your life. And there's so many examples of that across time, not only how Waiting for Godot moved me in New Orleans, but something as classic as Waiting for Godot, written by this Irishman, Mr. Beckett,
yes,
under the duress of occupied France by the Nazis. The play then spoke to another generation across time and generations and space when Susan Sontag did it in the Eastern Bloc in the Balkans, and then to have it speak to a community and decades later in New Orleans. It just gives you an example of how transformative art can be, how impactful a piece can be.
And how it endures so across time.
Yeah, and that's the thing that makes it classic, because no matter what walk of life you're from, Susan, our humanity is our common thread. And when you can create a piece of art that speaks to your humanity across time, across generations, that will outlive you, that's the thing that makes it classic. And that's the thing that I'm proud of when it comes to what we created with Treme. Because years from now, some little kid can come up to me and say, Mr. Pierce, in New Orleans Darkest Hour, what did you do? And I can say, look at this. And it was therapeutic for the community where they looked at Treme and said, okay, that's where we were just a couple of years ago. I'm moving forward. It was a time for people to reflect and bring resilience, bring fortitude, bring comfort, and bring hopefully some healing. And when art can do that, that's transformative. And that's what I've tried to capture in the book, The Wind and the Reeds.
Oh, and you have. But in addition to being an artistic autobiography, it's also a spiritual autobiography. And I really love the way you recount that pilgrimage you made to Fatima for your own 50th birthday.
Yeah. My mother, after she passed away 3 years ago, one of the divine interventions of Treme is the fact that it brought me home, so I was able to spend the last years of my mother's life with her home. And my 50th birthday came along after her death, and my mother was a great devotee of the Blessed Mother. And I said, let me go somewhere in the world where the Blessed Mother made an appearance, you know. And I thought of all these places, and I thought of Fatima. And so for my 50th birthday, alone, I said, I'm going to go to Fatima. I'm going to try to reconnect. My mother, one of her dying wishes was, Wendell, please, you know, go back to church.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a regular church goer, so she wanted me to really reconnect with my faith and spirituality. And so I went there, and I was really trying to reconnect with my mother. And there was this beautiful moment. It was on my birthday, the Immaculate Conception. I like to remind people of that. And it was this beautiful day in Portugal at Fatima, hundreds of thousands of people, and the procession of the Blessed Mother back to her place of honor on the spot where she appeared to the three children a generation ago. I turned around filled with emotion, knowing that I was trying to commune with my mother and had gone all these months really in grief, trying to reconnect, missing her. And I looked up, and here I was across the ocean on the other side of the earth watching this procession and all of these handkerchiefs go up. I look at it and I say, oh, I know that vision. It was like this beautiful Sakyamai and a celebration of all these pilgrims who, like my mother, shared this devotion to the Blessed Mary. And it was another moment of awakening for me, saying that I had been grieving all those months and that year, like a second line in New Orleans. There was the commonality and the humanity of the pilgrims there in Fatima, Portugal, with this man from New Orleans grieving for his mother. And in that moment, I was able to let go and realize that I had spent my birthday with my mother. She had given me all she had to give me, and I was ready to move on with my life with the lessons only a beloved mother can give. And it was a beautiful spiritual moment that reminded me of the transformative nature of art, because it was grace in motion, it was grace in reality.
Well, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous passage in that book. You know, your friend Stanley Crouch coined the most wonderful description of Louis Armstrong. He said he was an ambassador for joy. And I think you are too, and you're an eloquent ambassador for our city's pain as well. We've been talking with the one, the only, the great Wendell Pierce. Don't miss his beautiful memoir, The Wind and the Reeds, A Storm, a Play, and a City That Would Not Be Broken. Wendell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Elise Blackwell teaches at the University of South Carolina, where she organizes and hosts the open book series with visiting authors. Her fifth novel, The Lower Quarter, takes place in New Orleans naturally in a post-Katrina landscape where four very interesting characters move in and out of each other's lives. It's a nod to her childhood growing up in South Louisiana. Elise is the author of four previous novels, including The Unnatural History of Cypress Parish. Elise, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you, Susan. I'm delighted to be on the show.
Now, one of the things I love about your work is that each book is so different. You've written about young writers in contemporary New York, The Siege of Leningrad, Hunger is one of my favorites, Louisiana in 1927, and now here you are in post-Katrina New Orleans. So set the scene for us a bit.
Yes, I was on book tour in 2007 for my second novel, and I toured the Mississippi Gulf Coast while I was there, and then a couple of days later found myself in a hotel in the lower quarter sitting on a rather garish bedspread talking on an old black landline that I wound up importing into the novel. And I had that weird feeling of being in a film. I think it's a feeling that might happen to writers more than ordinary people, or at least being on the set of a noir. And the book grew from that feeling.
And I think the feeling of being in a movie often happens to people in New Orleans, you know?
It does, and I think that often happens in New Orleans because we've seen so many movies set in the city. But there's also something about the place that's self-conscious, I think.
Self-conscious and photogenic, too.
Indeed.
So tell us a bit about these four characters in the lower quarter. They all have such difficult backgrounds, and they're all bound by choices, and they're all bound by their desire for a work of art.
Yes, and each of these characters is carrying some personal damage that preceded Hurricane Katrina. Only one was actually in the city during the storm. And one of the challenges of the book is that each of the characters, if left to his or her own devices, is a loner. And so I had to sort of rub them up against each other, put them in uncomfortable situations, and get them to act. Johanna is an art restorer from another country who sort of adopted New Orleans and its history as her own. Eli is the classic noir detective character. He's a former art thief himself who now works for a somewhat mysterious organization whose job is to recover lost art. And he's in New Orleans looking for a missing painting. Clay is sort of my uptown degenerate character. He comes from a wealthy New Orleans family and makes a bit of hobby out of seeking revenge on people he doesn't like. And then Marion as a bartender in the quarter, who herself is a young aspiring artist who's lost her work in the storm.
You did a great job with Clay, I've got to tell you.
Thank you. And he was a challenge because he's not a likable guy. You know, he's a bad guy. And I had to find ways to find writerly sympathy for him. And I hope a little bit of readerly sympathy as well.
So I'm curious, now that you've invented a detective, will you bring him back again?
Oh, I don't know. I really do like the character, and I would like to follow him again. But unlike a classic noir where the whole novel would have been told in his point of view and Johanna would have been his femme fatale, he's just one of four characters, and I wanted to complicate him from the traditional hard-boiled detective. He's a bit of a lost soul. But I don't know, maybe. I'm going to think about that.
Now, you write this, you know, from four different points of view. That must have been a lot of fun for you.
It was a lot of fun. It drove me crazy at times, deciding who should tell which part of the story, and making sure that a reader's attention would be engaged while it was suspended to hear from another character. But it was also a lot of fun, and I really wanted it to be everybody's story, as well as the story of the part of the city I was writing about itself.
Now, as a stylist, was it a challenge to you to adopt, you know, the conventions of noir? Did you read a lot? Did you kind of look for those things?
Yes, I grew up not watching much television or not seeing very many movies, so I actually haven't seen very much noir, but I've read a little bit of it, and I teach at a university that's recently been collecting the papers of several prominent noir authors, you know, from Elmore Leonard back to Bethel Hammett. And so that was a lot of fun, but I definitely am not writing in that hard-boiled detective Raymond Chandler kind of voice. But I wanted to suggest it and to use some of the tropes of noir, the detective, the mysterious woman working out of her own motivations, and that kind of the color of the set, the black and the white and the gray, was in my mind sort of as a tone for the novel as I wrote it.
So did you come and do research about post-Katrina New Orleans to see what would be possible for these characters?
I did. And of course, I was doing the research a bit later than the novel set. The novel set in 2005, mm-hmm. Really quite soon after the storm. And I was not there until a bit later. But I did. I talked to a lot of people. I did some research. And I take any excuse I can get to go to New Orleans. So I wrote myself a grant requiring a trip to study some of the micro settings of the city, even though I really didn't need to. I already knew them. And so I was lucky enough to make several trips back to New Orleans in the writing. And I took a couple of liberties about when things reopened. I have the reopening of the zoo as it really was, but I have the reopening of certain establishments and bars happening a little earlier than they in fact did.
I love that there are nods to Faulkner House books in this novel.
Yes, well, I love Joe and Rosemary, and they've been very good to me. And I thought they were such an important part of the post-Katrina narrative in New Orleans, and so I wanted to give them a nod. And I also thought it was very much in character for Johanna to go into that store.
Oh, absolutely. And also there's a nod to Moira Crohn's novel, The Not Yet, as well.
That's a very good catch. Moira was my professor at Louisiana State when I was 19 years old. The first literature class I took in college was with her, and I adored her. And we have stayed in touch off and on over the years, and I'm a great fan of her work. So I wanted to just put a small nod in there.
So everything comes full circle, you know. Now, one of the things you write so beautifully about these individuals' relationship to the city and about the choice of home and choosing to bind a personal history to the history of a place. And there's this moment where Johanna thinks there were waves of good lives here before and there would be waves of good lives here again. The city could give that to people, at least those who were willing to see it. The city could give this to her. And I think that so beautifully captures what people felt who moved here, that sense of possibility and choice, you know?
Yes, and I think New Orleans has always been a great receiver of immigrants, some voluntary and, of course, some horribly involuntary. And the immigrants who've come have become very much part of the city. And one of the things I was thinking about in the novel was just what it means to sort of be corporeally bound, what it means to migrate across borders, whether you want to or you're forced to, what it means to be caught on one side of a border or not, what it means to be trapped in a city, unable to evacuate when you want to, or the ability to move. And for Johanna, New Orleans represents freedom to her. She has been there, I guess, about a decade before the storm, and has made it her home. She's chosen it. She was forced from her home against her will. And so this is an act of her sort of taking control.
Well, there's such lovely writing in this book. It's really an amazing book. The whole time you read it, you can't quite escape it. You know, I kept putting it down. I go, oh, no, and go back to see what happened.
That's music to a writer's ear.
Oh, I hope so. Well, we've been talking with Elise Blackwell, whose wonderful new book is The Lower Quarter. Trust me, you won't be able to put it down either. You can meet Elise Thursday, September 24th at 6 at Octavia Books, or Wednesday, October 28th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop, and she'll be back in town for Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, October 29th through 31st. Elise, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure to be on the show.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Stuart Stevens discusses The Last Season, A Father, A Son, and A Lifetime of College Football, Tuesday, September 22nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Richard Campanella discusses Geographies of New Orleans, Wednesday, September 23rd at 6 at the New Orleans Public Library, Main Library. One Book, One New Orleans sponsors a panel discussion, Lil Wayne and America's Idea of New Orleans, Wednesday, September 23rd from 6 to 8:30 at the Dillard University Library Commons. Brad Richard and Aaron Donovan kick off the Bloodjet Poetry Series, Wednesday, September 22nd at 8 at BJ's in the Bywater. Today's guest, Elise Blackwell, discusses and signs The Lower Quarter, Thursday, September 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. George Sanchez discusses and signs his mystery featuring Jeff Chaussier, Explorations End, Thursday, September 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Dogfish Reading Series presents Andy Young, author of All Night It Is Morning, Thursday, September 24th at 7 at the Old North Fillory Bakery, 2448 North Fillory. Cops and Authors, a small mystery writers conference featuring three police officers turned authors, takes place Saturday, September 26th at 10 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The gathering is designed to provide hands-on practical information to local mystery and crime writers, but it's also open to anyone who wants to understand more fully the concepts of police procedure. O'Neill Deneau, Southeastern Louisiana University Police Department detective, presents New Orleans as a partner in crime at 10 a.m. Scott Silveri, the retired chief of police of the city of Thibodaux, discusses cop culture at 11:15. And B.J. Borg, patrol cop detective and SWAT officer, and psychologist Amanda Borg present Inside the Mind of a Police Sniper and Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder at 12:30. The Jane Austen Society of North America, Louisiana Region, discusses Sense and Sensibility, Saturday, September 26th from 2 to 4 at the Rosa Keller Library. Actress Lea Michele of Glee signs her book, You First, Journal Your Way to Your Best Life, Saturday, September 26th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Order the book to receive a wristband admitting you to the event at Eventbrite, or call the shop at 895-2266 for information. WYES presents a screening of the PBS series Indian Summers and a book signing by photographer and author Robert Arnett discussing effects of the British Raj on modern India. That's Saturday, September 26th at 5 at Metairie Park Country Day School. Tickets available at WYES.org. Rick Barton discusses and signs In the Wake of the Flagship, Tuesday, September 29th at 6 at Octavia Books. Coming up, Contraflow, the science fiction and fantasy fan convention, takes place October 2nd through 4th at the Kenner Airport Hilton. This is the convention's fifth anniversary, and this year they've teamed up with Deep South Con 53 for an even larger gathering. The lineup includes 40 guest authors, including renowned science fiction author Robert J. Sawyer, as well as artists, gaming experts, scientists, and musicians. For more information and tickets, check out ContraflowSciFi.org. Also, the Women's National Book Association celebrates National Reading Group Month at the New Orleans Museum of Art October 3rd. There will be a book club meet and greet from 12:30 to 1, followed by keynote speaker Nancy Dixon at 1. At 2 p.m., there will be an author panel including Sybil Morial, C.S. Harris, Tiffany Kai Tyson, Richard Wall, husband of the late author Carol Wall, Kent Wascom, Karen White, and John Ed Bradley. This will be followed by book signing at 3, then tea with the authors at Cafe Noma. All events are free except for the author tea. All book groups and book lovers are welcome. For more information, check out the Women's National Book Association of New Orleans Facebook page. Also on October 3rd, Emily Lamy's Fine Arts Bookshop will be moving to the Contemporary Arts Center, starting off in the cafe. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.